elevated tension and troop numbers in the Russia-Ukraine border crisis. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin with the common sense analysis.
You don't do these sort of things for no reason. And you certainly don't do them if you're getting ready to pack up and go home.
I'm Marco Werman. We'll have the latest from NATO allies on the threat from Moscow and a legal case in Lebanon that could make human rights history.
Not only will this be a precedent, but this will also open so many doors for such future cases.
Also today, every shipwreck tells a story. For some divers, many wrecks evoke historic suffering.
And I have to say that I have to clear my mask, and when I clear my mask, I add a few more pints of water to the ocean from tears that came down my face.
Exploring the wreck of a ship that transported people into slavery. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. It's good to have you with us today. Despite what NATO allies are calling disinformation from the Kremlin that suggests they're pulling back troops, President Joe Biden says Russia could invade Ukraine within the next several days.
Every indication we have is they're prepared to go into Ukraine, attack Ukraine.
Biden speaking on the White House lawn today. Also today, news that Russia has expelled the number two U.S. diplomat in Moscow. The State Department says it sees that as an escalation. Moscow has said several times this week that they're moving some troops and equipment away from Ukraine, but neither the U.S. nor NATO see that as a sign of true de-escalation. NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg mentioned the claims today.
The fact that you're putting a battle tank on a train and move it in some direction doesn't prove withdrawal of troops. That's not the same as real de-escalation, because these capabilities are moving around all the time, in and out.
Western powers estimate Russia now has more than 150,000 troops amassed outside Ukraine's borders. Some are inching closer to Ukraine. That's according to comments from U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin today, who also mentioned Russia is flying in more combat and support aircraft, even stocking up on blood supplies.
You know, I was a soldier myself not that long ago, and I know firsthand that you don't do these sort of things for no reason. And you certainly don't do them if you're getting ready to pack up and go home.
The U.S. government believes Russia is engaged in a false flag operation to provide an excuse to attack Ukraine. Secretary Austin says Washington is going to keep a sharp focus on Russia's movements.
We will closely match Russian words to Russian deeds, what they say to what they actually do.
Meanwhile, from France, an announcement about very certain troop movements from President Emmanuel Macron. He said today that the 2,000-plus French military that have been in Mali for the past 9 years will leave. They've been there helping the government in Mali fight Islamist extremists.
Nous ne pouvons pas rester engagés militairement aux côtés d'autorités de fait.
Macron said we can't remain military partners with a government that does not share our same strategy and hides its own goals.
On prit la décision de retirer leur présence militaire au Mali.
And so France and its partners are pulling out their troops. Delina Gojo is a security analyst who's focused on West Africa and the Sahel. Speaking this morning from Niger, she told me the breakdown in diplomacy in the past 2 weeks has been dramatic.
If you had asked me this last year or 2 years ago, I would have said that there was no way that Barkhane would leave ever in the near future. But I think in recent years, because of the escalation in diplomatic tensions, the situation has been worsening, and this is something that we expected.
So a diplomatic rupture between France and Mali, what led to that?
The Malian transition government potential relations with Wagner Group, which is a Russian paramilitary group. Then there was a reaction on the part of French foreign minister to this. And in general, Mali's non-compliance with ECOWAS mandated timelines for elections after the second coup.
ECOWAS, that's the West African Community of Economic States.
Exactly. So the timelines given by ECOWAS were not respected by the Malian junta after the second coup, which occurred last year. And finally, the straw that broke the camel's back was the expulsion of French ambassador to Mali and this growing hostility from Mali's new governing military junta towards the Danish contingent of Takuba. Takuba is a special forces operation made up of a number of European countries.
So let's back up a bit. France first intervened in Mali 9 years ago to try to drive out Islamist extremists and stop their attacks in the north of Mali. Can you tell us more about the original motivation and what the goal was of this intervention?
The original motivation at the time, and this was 2012, was that the Malian president himself had asked the former president of France, Françoise Hollande, to intervene in the country and protect Bamako, but also the rest of the country from Islamist militants, as you will put it, and rebel groups. The fear was that they were moving further south and they would potentially reach Bamako. So at the time, France intervened through an operation called Opération Serval, which only lasted about a year, even less than that. And Operation Serval was very different from Barkhane. It was a consequential operation. So the way it was even described to the Malian and the French public was very much consequential. So every sort of operation and every tactic was well described. It would have a result. Villages would be progressively liberated.
Yeah, Barkhane being the French operation in Mali. I mean, meantime, jihadists have moved south and into other countries, Burkina Faso, even as far south as the border of Ghana. How would you describe the success of France's intervention in Mali? Did it achieve any of what it set out to do?
The idea with Barkhane is to stem violence levels, but also to keep them beneath a certain threshold. I believe because the situation is very problematic in the region, I don't know whether we could say that Barkhane has been a successful mission. And so some of the concerns of the Malian civil society, but also the Malian population, and to some extent the transition government as well, make sense. Civilians are being killed by the day. The same is happening with armed forces. And there doesn't seem to be a higher level of security in any of the villages around the tri-border area, but also further south, tri-border area being the area between Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso.
I saw that the chair of the West African Regional Organization, ECOWAS, Nana Akufo-Addo, he's also the president of Ghana, he said that terrorists must not find a permanent home in West Africa. What has been the reaction across the region to this news of France ending its military commitment in Mali?
So I think there is a huge level of concern on the part of other leaders in the region. At the same time, they are particularly worried that if they show to be too complacent with France, they will have opposition within military ranks, but also from the civilian population. So it's a very, it's a juggling game. I mean, they have to pay attention to a number of issues, the terrorist groups, but also the civilian population, but also their military apparatus.
What happens now in Mali, Delina?
What will happen, I think, in the short term is going to be quite dramatic. There will be a vacuum in the short term in terms of counterterrorism operations and air power, unless Barkhane chooses to intervene through air power from Niger. But again, it cannot intervene in Mali anymore.
Delina Gojo is a security analyst focused on West Africa and the Sahel. She's been speaking with us from Niamey in Niger. Delina, thank you very much for your thoughts on this.
Thank you.
The man convicted of a high-profile so-called honor killing in Pakistan is set to go free after a court decision this week. In 2016, Wasim Azim killed his sister, Kantil Baloch, one of Pakistan's biggest social media stars. He has served 6 years in prison, and now his family has asked for his release under a pardon provision in Islamic law. For more on this, we turn to Sanam Maher. She's a Pakistani journalist and author of A Woman Like Her, The Short Life of Kantil Baloch. Sanam says the star blazed a trail to a new culture in Pakistan.
She was Pakistan's first social media celebrity, the first person really who understood what it meant to go viral over here and how going viral can translate into being famous, into all sorts of opportunities. And she was a young woman who used platforms like Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube to just, you know, show us everything from a new dress she'd bought, which may have been a little skimpy, or a new song she wanted to sing for us, or to give us an update on her love life. And we could not stop looking at her. We'd never seen a woman behave publicly in the way that she did. We couldn't stop talking about her. She kept us looking at her for long enough to the point where we wouldn't even stop to ask, who is this woman? Why is she all over my newsfeed all of a sudden? She'd been married before. She'd had a child as well. She had been in an abusive marriage. She worked her way up to becoming the most talked about woman in Pakistan. And in July 2016, her brother killed her for showing herself in public the way that she did, because he said it brought disrespect to their family.
So some have called her the Kim Kardashian of Pakistan. Fair comparison?
It ignores the fact that she came from nothing. She really did come from a small village in southern Punjab, mud floors, mud walls, you know, just to work your way up to becoming who she did. It is easy to explain the level of notoriety she had, but it does ignore the fact that she had to work very hard and be very clever to get where she did.
So the brother was found guilty and given a life sentence. In Pakistan, the victim's family can pardon the murderer, but the parents chose not to at the time. What changed?
In what is referred to as an honor killing, where a crime like this takes place against a man or a woman, usually it's someone within the community or more often than not, someone within the family who will kill them in order to restore respect or honor to the family, in order to send a message to the rest of the community or society that we found this person's behavior unacceptable. They stepped outside of the bounds of the rules of our society and they have been punished for it. And so Kandil's brother, he did kill her. But then at the same time, so this was in July 2016, and the murder made such news over here that the government changed the laws regarding honor killing. So even if the family forgives you, you are still likely to get life in prison. It just removed a loophole where families could forgive the killer and they would walk free.
So what happened most recently? Why was the brother acquitted?
What his lawyer argued was that the law was changed after Kandil's death, and he argued that you can't retroactively apply it to that crime. The government has said that they will challenge the verdict, and a lot of activists have gotten behind it. My guess is it's probably a lack of evidence. It's witnesses turning around and retracting their statements. There's also been a change in circumstance. Kandil's father passed away last year, and he was very much in favor of his son being punished for this crime. Kandil's mother is now all alone. She's already lost her daughter. She may not want to lose her son as well to life in prison. She may have appealed to the court to set him free.
What has been the reaction in Pakistan to this news?
There's been a lot of outrage about it. He's only served 6 years in prison. And this was one of the most, if not the most, high-profile honor killings in the country. So it's really a question of, what is the state going to do? That's what everybody is wanting to see. What does the state see its role as being in this case? Are you going to challenge it and send a message that this is just not allowed and you can't take the law into your hands in this way? Or are you going to just let it go?
So Sanam, in 2016, as you mentioned, after the killing of Kandil Balosh, the Pakistan parliament passed an anti-honor killing and anti-rape bill. But according to one NGO research organization, 1,000 so-called honor killings continue to happen each year. Why is the legislation not being enforced?
It's not so much about the legislation not being enforced. I don't believe that changing the laws is the only thing you need in this case. There needs to be a massive overhaul in how these crimes are treated. You can change the law, but what will inevitably happen is that the crimes are just going to be hidden. So a family could turn around and say, no, this was a suicide. This wasn't an honor killing. What do you do in that case?
If the brother of Kandil is eventually released, what will that do to the movement to stop these killings?
I don't think it's going to stop because I think the voices for Kandil are so loud. What happened to her was felt so deeply. She was somebody that we knew. She wasn't just another nameless woman. She was on our Facebook feed. She was in the news all the time. We knew her face. We thought we knew who she was. And the fact that she was killed in this manner, it affected many people really deeply. And I do think that even if he is set free, we won't stop speaking about these cases. We won't stop working to change the laws, to strengthen them, to close such loopholes, to make sure that they don't happen. Even now, the outrage around it, it hasn't died down. And it just tells you how important she was to us.
Sanam Maher is a journalist in Karachi and the author of the book, A Woman Like Her, The Short Life of Kandil Balosh. Thank you very much for being with us to talk about this.
Thanks for having me.
Just ahead, we'll take scuba diving to new depths of meaning with divers who explore the historic wrecks of slave ships. You're listening to The World.
The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/wise. world.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Say the word shipwreck, and for many people, there always seems to be one clear image that comes to mind.
They literally think about the Titanic. They think, oh, this is an intact wreck, and we can see it. And then on the side, it literally says Titanic.
Diver Jay Hagler there, and if he sounds cynical, it's because he knows that there are many shipwrecks out there with stories and histories that are a lot more difficult to uncover, but incredibly important. Jay Hagler was speaking on Into the Depths, a podcast that explores the wreckage of ships that transported enslaved Africans. It's produced by National Geographic and hosted by National Geographic explorer Tara Roberts. She joins us from Atlanta. And in Washington, we have Kamal Siddiqui. He's a lead instructor at Diving with a Purpose. Thank you both for joining us.
Yes. Yeah, thanks for having us, Marco.
The stories on Into the Depths follow, to a large degree, the work of your group, Kamal, Diving with a Purpose. So let me start with you. Tell us more about this organization, Diving with a Purpose, and its mission.
Well, DWP got it started about maybe 17 years ago, around 2004 or so. And what we do, we focused on assisting maritime archaeologists. You know, we say we are not maritime archaeologists. We are maritime archaeology advocates, and we assist them in documenting shipwrecks, but we have a particular interest in slave shipwrecks. Not only focus on those wrecks, but also a little bit on coral reef restoration. So our tagline is restoring our oceans and preserving our heritage.
So Tara, as Kamal just said, I mean, there's a strong historical component to the work of Diving with a Purpose. For you and what you've been looking at, is there an estimate of the number of shipwrecks connected to the trade in enslaved humans? Like, where are they mostly?
They estimate that there were about 36,000 voyages that brought 12.5 million Africans to the Americas. And of that number, they think as many as 1,000 of those ships wrecked. But to date, less than 10 of them have been found. Historians are still locating them. They're off coastlines inside of the major ports. That's what we believe, the major ports where the slave trade was strong.
So Into the Depths, your podcast with National Geographic, is part of its mission to reveal more of these shipwrecks and understand their history.
Yeah, we talk about the ships. We also talk about the people who were lost on the ships. And we talk about the divers and the communities that are involved in helping to bring this history up from the ocean's depths. So it's a little bit of all of that.
So Kamal, we'll get to one particular shipwreck that you were part of looking at and discovering and involved with. What have you learned as kind of, you know, advising underwater archaeologists?
It's been an incredible journey. I worked on a project off the coast of Cape Town, South Africa. The name of the wreck was the São José Paquete de Africa that was coming from Mozambique and trying to get to Brazil. But unfortunately, it went down in the bay in off of Cape Town, where 212 individuals lost their lives. And I recall very clearly, Marco, the first time I dove that wreck, I remember seeing the cannons and the being tossed about with the surge, but I came upon this wooden member that was either part of the ship or part of the cargo of the ship. And I just recall grabbing that member, Marco, and the energy that came through me it was palpable. I could feel the pain and the horror and the suffering.
It was encrusted. It was concreted in the material, but the shape was, you had a loop and a rod. Another loop, and yeah, it was a shackle. It was like you can hear the screams and the hollow and the hollering and the pain and suffering that people must have went through in the agony of being on a vessel in shackles that's sinking and breaking up in the sea. And, you know, in scuba diving, you know, we wear a mask and sometimes they get foggy, but mine got wet from tears. I just couldn't hold it back, and so I did like that, put some water in there, washed it off, opened up my mask and washed the tears out.
Very intense. Tara, you were also on that trip to South Africa and looking into what happened to the Portuguese slave ship, the São José. What was that trip like for you?
It was really healing for me. I could imagine what it must have been like. I didn't dive the site But I was able to stand at the wreck site and to see what was there and to imagine it. And you could feel the energy from the ocean, but you could also feel another energy. And I don't know if there's a moment for Kamal to share about the ceremony that helped bring some healing and some closure to that moment.
Mm, it is a powerful moment. Can you talk about that, Kamal?
Yeah, sure, Marco. You know, we treat these sites as very sacred sites. So the chief, Ivano Ngochi, he gave us some soil from the village of in Musareal there, and he told us to take this soil back to the site and, in effect, bring our people back home. So we went to the site, and we had the intentions of diving it, but the swells and the waves, it was very turbulent. It was rough seas that day. And so we decided to go down on the beach and wade out into the water as close to the site as we could. It's about 300 feet off the beach. Mm. And we did this ritual of depositing the soil on the site. And again, it was extremely emotional. You can just feel it. It was very palpable. I had thought about it all night and had these words I wanted to recite. But, you know, the ancestors said, be silent and just bring our people back home. And so we went back to the village and to the elder real quickly and told the elder that we had fulfilled his mission. And he went into this sort of profound pause. And then he said, I'm sort of paraphrasing here, now that you have done this, the rains that are falling on our village now is like the tears of our ancestors fertilizing our soil all over again.
Wow.
So that was an extreme moment as well.
Tara, clearly these expeditions are more than just finding ships. It's unearthing history and confirming history. Why do you think that matters today?
Just in the numbers that I mentioned earlier, I think there's a story inside of that. If there are 1,000 ships, possibly 1,000 ships out there, but less than 10 have been found, that indicates that there's a lot of history out there that's just missing. Also, this work is a huge opportunity to honor those people who've never been honored collectively. So like the ceremony that Kamal described, that's the sort of work that is possible. And through that, I think, comes an opportunity for healing.
Tara Roberts with National Geographic and Kamal Siddiqui of DWP Diving with a Purpose. They're a big part of the podcast, Into the Depths, a series about the search for shipwrecks, ships that transported enslaved Africans. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. Tara and Kamal, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having us.
Really appreciate it.
There's a lot more ahead in the next half hour of the show. You're listening to The World. Hello, it's Marco. In October 2021, we set an ambitious goal of raising $67,000 for The World. Before the end of the year, we had raised over $86,000. This is an incredible feat we could not have done alone. Here are some of the people who made that possible. Eileen Krause, Mary Kreider, Raymond Kuji, Mel Langdon, Penelope Lapham, Amrith Laxman, Brian Lee, Peter Lewis, Vanessa Lucio, Edward McGee. Thanks to everybody who answered the call and for those who continue to listen to the show every day. Despite its poor record on human rights, China was awarded the Beijing Olympics. That recognition feels like a gut punch for a woman whose husband has been held in a detention camp in China.
One day, he just disappeared. He stopped replying to my texts, stopped picking up my phone calls.
Her story, and we unpack the latest COVID numbers, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. First, the good news. COVID is on the decline in the U.S. The CDC reports that in most states, new infections are down by 50% or more in the last 2 weeks. It's a global trend as well, according to the World Health Organization. New confirmed cases have dropped almost 20% worldwide in the last week. There are exceptions.
Dozens of COVID-19 patients in Hong Kong were being treated in beds outside medical centers on Wednesday.
All 7.5, nearly 8 million residents of Hong Kong will be tested for the coronavirus over the next few weeks.
And Hong Kong is not surging alone. South Korea today reported more than 90,000 new infections, a record high. Similar story in Singapore. Their trade minister announced 20,000 new COVID cases yesterday.
We are now in the middle of this Omicron wave and are still climbing the epidemic curve.
Disease expert David Heyman says those countries I just mentioned have been hit especially hard by Omicron.
Those countries have had a policy of no COVID. And so as a result, they have to depend on vaccination to get their population immunity levels.
Heyman teaches epidemiology at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. He says that Omicron has caused relatively fewer very serious cases of COVID in the UK and the US, thanks in part to antibodies from previous infections.
The countries that are having a steady decline in reported number of cases being admitted to hospitals or deaths are countries where there's probably a high level of population immunity.
Heyman points out that in countries across Africa, where COVID has been widespread, many people have been previously infected with the virus, which may provide some protection against serious illness from Omicron. But relatively few people are vaccinated. That could very well change, thanks to news this week from the German company BioNTech. They unveiled details of plans to set up new manufacturing on the continent. This follows major recent advances in mRNA efforts in South Africa. The World's Ilana Gordon covers global health for the show and has been following this. So mRNA vaccines, Ilana, have been in high demand throughout the pandemic, kind of the gold standard of vaccines, but Africa has largely been left out. How does this new BioNTech effort address that?
Yeah, so like you were saying, Africa as a continent has been completely dependent on imports of mRNA vaccines. And so what that's meant during the pandemic is the shots have gone to wealthy regions that control the manufacturing, like in the US and Europe. And companies like BioNTech, they faced a lot of pressure from the international community to do something about this. CEO Ugor Sahin recognized the problem this week.
And for us, the question was, what can we do to ensure our mRNA manufacturing technology could be made accessible anywhere on the planet?
And he announced that BioNTech is setting up facilities in Rwanda and Senegal. Ghana will be involved to make mRNA vaccines.
So how's that going to work and what's the timeline?
So it's pretty interesting, Marco. The facilities, they're going to be modular in design. So picture a lot of shipping containers, like a dozen per unit, and they'll contain all the necessary steps to make the vaccine on site. BioNTech is calling them BioNTainers.
BioNTech's got to stay on brand, I guess.
Yeah. BioNTech staff will oversee it for now, and the goal is to have it all set up later this year. They hope to start making up to 50 million doses a year once it's up and going sometime the following year, so 2023.
So it sounds like this won't address the vaccines for right now. Only like 11% of the continent, I understand, has been vaccinated. How are leaders in Africa responding to this?
Well, the announcement happened in Germany, but some big leaders from Africa were there. And they were super excited, like the president of the African Union and Senegal, Macky Sall.
Ce jour est historique. Ce jour nous permet de mettre fin à une injustice vaccinal ou pendant une pandémie.
So Macky Sall is saying this day is historic. This day allows us to bring an end to vaccine injustice. This has impacted the world and left the African continent stranded, he said.
Yeah, and this was really the theme. The president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, was there.
I think the importance of today cannot be overemphasized.
And Ghana's president, Nana Akufo-Addo, was there too.
Today represents indeed a momentous day for Mother Africa. Another step in the process of self-reliance has been taken.
And Marco, they really hope this will be a big step in becoming more self-sufficient. And as Ghana's president said, prevent them from being at the mercy of foreign vaccine nationalism and geopolitics in the future.
But Ilana, if I get this right, it seems BioNTech is still overseeing and controlling the efforts. How does this create more self-sufficiency?
Well, on the one hand, manufacturing on the continent is a big deal. Geography is just so important. And this will involve training people in country. The hope is to build up infrastructure. But many are also wary of the announcement, too. I talked with Matt Kavanaugh. He's an advisor with UNAIDS, and he's a global health professor at Georgetown University.
Really, it's an effort in many ways to hold on to the monopoly that they currently have. They're literally just shipping containers over that they will own.
And his point is that companies control the manufacturing still, wherever they are. And that means they control the supply and the cost, and that creates dependency. But at the same time, he contrasts that with this other really unprecedented effort that's taking shape in South Africa at this company called Afrigen.
Afrigen, right. You reported on this last week.
Yeah, it's a collaboration with the World Health Organization, and the whole idea is to encourage companies to share mRNA technology so that low- and middle-income countries can learn to make it and control the production themselves. BioNTech and Moderna, they are not participating. But even so, this month, Afrigen announced that they managed to make their own version of Moderna's vaccine. You know, this will still take years to get into people's arms, but the head of Afrigen, Petro Terblanche, told me that not having Moderna involved actually turned out to be a blessing in disguise.
It is a fantastic thing for us that we're not boxed in.
They're not boxed in. They're learning and figuring out to make their own version of the technology. And they plan to share that knowledge with other countries. You know, with both these efforts, with the BioNTechs and Afrigens, the real hope is that the expansion of this mRNA technology around the world can be used not just for COVID-19, actually, but for future vaccines, like for TB, malaria, and even HIV.
The world's Alana Gordon. Thank you very much. Thanks for your reporting.
Yeah, thanks, Marco.
Every year, people, especially from countries in Africa and South Asia, travel to Lebanon for work. They get there with the help of recruiting agencies, and most take jobs in private households as domestic workers. They're mostly women who go to Lebanon in hopes of sending money back home to their families. For a long time, many have reported abuse and mistreatment. Now, an Ethiopian woman is taking her former employer and the recruitment agency to court. The world's Shirin Jafari reports.
They will beat us, they will kill us, there is no one to help us.
This singer goes by the name Lucy. She's with a group of domestic workers in Lebanon called the United Sisters, and they made this video in 2020. Lucy, who's from Sierra Leone, describes what she and thousands of other domestic workers face every day.
So the idea of the video was when I met Lucy and her group of stranded women in Beirut 2 years ago.
Aline Deschamps is a photojournalist based in Beirut.
She said to me that she had written a song and she sang it to me. And this song was basically a love letter to her children that she thought she'll never be able to meet again.
Deschamps has been documenting the lives of domestic workers in Lebanon for the past 2 years. When she met this group, they had just fled abusive households, and they were stranded in Beirut. Their employers had taken away their passports and hadn't paid their wages. Lebanon's domestic worker sponsorship program, known as the kafala system, allows for such abuse, says Farah Baba. She's with the anti-racism movement, a group that advocates for the rights of migrant workers in Lebanon.
It guarantees absolute authority and power to the employer, who is the legal sponsor of the migrant domestic worker.
Baba says the recruitment agencies that bring workers to Lebanon are part of the problem. She knows of cases where they simply lie to those searching for a job.
They were told that they were going to Dubai or that they were going to the US or that they would be coming to Lebanon to be French teachers. They're not always told that they would be working as domestic workers.
Often, foreign workers are too afraid to come forward with complaints. In the cases that they do, they're not protected under Lebanese law. In 2020, Human Rights Watch said that Lebanon's judiciary is failing to protect domestic workers. Recently, though, one case is getting a lot of attention. An Ethiopian woman identified as MH is taking her former employer and recruitment agency to court. Antonia Malvi is the founder and executive director of Legal Action Worldwide, the agency that's representing MH.
The allegations include the fact that she was not paid by her former employer for more than 7 years. She worked 7 days a week with no holidays, often around 15 hours a day.
She wasn't allowed to leave the employer's apartment, Mavi adds. Her passport was confiscated and she was verbally and physically abused. I could not speak with MH for this story. Her legal case is ongoing. Attorney Antonia Mulvey says this case is significant because it brings forward allegations of slavery, and that is something new.
We have this in our mind of slavery, of people being chained and moved from the ships, as we remember, from Africa to the United States. But actually, under international law, there isn't any such thing as modern slavery. You either are enslaved or you are not.
MH moved back to Ethiopia in 2019. Mavi says it took a lot of courage to bring the case to court, and it could be a step towards changing the kafala system in Lebanon.
We hope that this case will be a catalyst for institutions within Lebanon to take action and to say enough is enough. If you lock somebody up, if you don't pay them, you can have a criminal case brought against you.
Lebanon is home to an estimated 250,000 domestic workers. Photojournalist Aline Deschamps has heard some of their stories as part of her work.
Some of them have never seen the sun. That's what they told me. Some of them didn't even know that Lebanon had a beach. That's how little they went outside.
The music video that Deschamps put together with the workers from Sierra Leone got a lot of attention. It helped raise enough money for the women to get back home. Today, Deschamps says that Lucy, the lead singer, is running an NGO that supports domestic workers from her country. She's also raising awareness about the kafala system in Lebanon.
She goes to the market with a megaphone to talk about the kafala system. And this is absolutely amazing because there is so much strength, there is so much courage, and there is so much beauty in the work that they are doing.
For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Before and during the Winter Olympics in Beijing, China has tried to send a clear message to athletes and spectators: keep politics out of it. Just enjoy the sports. For many people, though, that's impossible, especially people from the Uyghur ethnic minority, even for Uyghurs who live outside of China, because many have family members who've been detained or sent to prison camps. The World's Rebecca Canther spoke with a young Australian woman who's been separated from her husband for the last 4 years.
Mehrei Mezensoff is a 27-year-old nurse in Melbourne. She says she and her husband's love story started off like a romantic comedy. One day, her mom reconnected with a childhood friend back home in Xinjiang. And like moms do, they got to talking about their kids.
And then the next thing you know, my mom's introducing me to her best friend's son.
She showed her a picture of Mirzat Tahir, a tour guide in his hometown of Urumqi in Xinjiang, China. As Mehrei describes it, it was love at first sight, separated by 7,000 miles.
You know, it sounds like really cliche and like really cheesy, but just by looking at his face, I felt like this could, you know, potentially be the person that I spend the rest of my life with.
They started talking online, then calling each other almost every day. Mehrei says Mirzat was funny and kind. It only took a few months for him to pop the question.
I said yes. It probably sounds so crazy. I had never seen him before, like in real life.
So in the summer of 2016, she flew to Xinjiang. Mirzat was waiting at the Urumqi airport with flowers. 3 days later, they were married. Her husband applied for a visa and they planned to settle down together in Australia. The visa came through in April of 2017.
It was 2 days before we were about to leave. We had bought our tickets to Australia. We were pretty much packed in and ready to go. He got a call. We were just told that there were, you know, two police officers were coming.
They didn't know what to expect when the police showed up.
They asked their questions. Do you have a passport? Have you traveled overseas? And, you know, my husband had been to Turkey. He lived there for about a year.
That was enough to raise suspicions. The officers took Mirzat to the local police station for more questioning, and they confiscated his passport.
They said that while he was in Turkey during his stay there, that he had joined some kind of group and planned to bring down the Chinese government.
Mehrei scoffs at the idea of her easygoing husband being part of any anti-government group, but the authorities had different plans. They sent Mirzat to a detention camp. Chinese officials call it a re-education school. He was held there for 2 years. Then he was released, Mehrei says, and never charged with a crime.
They said, you've completed your studies. You can go into society and live a normal life just like everyone else.
But they didn't return his passport. Mehrei was able to make a trip to China to see her husband. She couldn't stay for long, though. She returned to Australia, and the couple continued their daily video calls.
One day, he just disappeared. He stopped replying to my texts, stopped picking up my phone calls. And then it was through his family that I found out that they had taken him in again.
This time, Mirzat was detained for 3 months. He was released, and then just a few weeks later, he learned he would be detained again. He managed one last call to his wife in Australia.
He was so scared. It was really traumatic not being by his side, being on the other side of the world, and then having to, you know, say goodbye to him.
That was a year and a half ago, the last time she talked with Mirzat. Now he's facing 25 years in prison on charges of separatism.
It's just this constant emotional roller coaster ride where I'm like, some days I'm like, I can get through this. We can get through this. Everything is going to be okay. And then other days it's just, I've completely hit rock bottom.
What gets her through it all, she says, is her Muslim faith and the support of others going through the same thing. It seems like every Uyghur family has a similar story, she says. And that's why Mehreh Mezensov says the Beijing Olympics just don't appeal to her at all.
It just kind of feels like a punch to the gut. But my husband is still being held prisoner. I want him to be okay. I need him to be okay.
But she says she's going to keep speaking up about what's happened to her husband in the hopes that he and so many other Uyghurs will be reunited with their families. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther.
Vladimir Putin likes to describe Russians and Ukrainians as one people. If you go back many centuries, like back to the 9th century, he's not entirely off the mark. Both countries can trace their roots back to the first East Slavic state known as Kievan Rus. It stretched from the Baltic to the Black Sea for hundreds of years until the mid-13th century. Since then, Russia and Ukraine have shared a complex and tangled history. We're going to spend a few minutes diving into that history with Faith Hillis. She's a professor of Russian history at the University of Chicago. So, Faith, Russia and Ukraine have been linked since at least the 9th century. Can you describe their earliest connection and shared roots?
Right. So Putin loves going back to this ancient history, to the history of Rus, to the history of the 19th century, and talking about Ukraine as a sort of little brother of Russia. But actually, this linked history is far more complicated than he represents. And that's because what we now look at as the Russian state actually traces its roots to Ukraine. The first East Slavic state was founded not in Russia, but in the city of Kiev, in the city in about 860. So at this point, you have the Slavs are just living as pagan tribes, but they actually invite Vikings who are traveling up and down the Dnipro River doing trade to form a state, and that state becomes Rus. And so this is the first time the East Slavs get an organized state. It's the state also that eventually gives them orthodoxy as a faith, and it also gives them a language, the Cyrillic alphabet, that they get from Greek missionaries. So both Russia and Ukraine look to this state as their origin story. This is very much at the heart of contemporary politics, right? Who owns this history? How do we trace these lines of lineage, and who can really claim it as their own?
So from Ukraine's kind of perspective, playing a pivotal role in the creation of the Russian Empire, when was that happening?
So in the early modern period, the region that we now know as Ukraine had come under Polish rule, and it had been Catholicized. Poles had moved into Ukraine to establish large agricultural estates, and with them they had brought Jews who served as a middleman class for this Polish elite. In this time period, you begin to get Orthodox resistance to this Polish order, and it's led by a group called the Cossacks, who are a group of escaped serfs and also peasants, and they take it as their mission to push Poles and Jews out of Ukraine. So in doing this, the Cossacks, first of all, look back to that Rus legacy. So here comes that question again, who owns Rus? So they eventually manage to establish a state that they call the Hetmanate. And this state is basically an independent agent, but it's aligned with the Muscovite Tsar, which shares a shared religion as well as certain common interests with them. And in this Hetmanate, these Cossacks establish Orthodox supremacy. They create a really dense network of religious academies. They set up all these religious printing presses, and they end up training most of the leaders of the Orthodox Church in the city of Kiev, leaders who serve in Ukraine, but also leaders who go north to Moscow. And in fact, a man named Feofan Prokopovich, who becomes the ideologist of Peter the Great in his autocracy, comes out of this Kiev religious academy and comes from Ukraine.
And if Orthodox supremacy was the goal, who was being kind of like put on the sidelines?
This very much involved the marginalization of Poles and Jews, and there was actually quite a lot of violence against them in this period. So there's many of the Cossacks who are participating in this campaign and who set up the Hetmanate actually talk of cleansing Rus of Poles and Jews. So the goal really is to get these people out and to reassert the supremacy of Orthodox believers.
It's really interesting. It folds into my own family story. Grandfather Jewish from a small town near Lviv in the west of Ukraine. He left for Krakow and then America in the late 19th century. I was too young when he was alive to have a talk with him about all this. But what would have been the majority view of Jews at the time of what was going on and of Moscow?
The view of the Jewish people at the time, they remember this period of the Hetmanate as one of great suffering. There are horrible military campaigns that persecute many civilians, and the persecution of Jews in the region only intensified in the 18th and 19th century when the Russian Empire did actually take over the region. So there were formal rules that prevented Jews from holding land, and then, of course, popular violence, pogroms, was always a threat.
Yeah, and that's the background to the Fiddler on the Roof story, isn't it?
Indeed, it sure is, yep.
Is it ironic that Ukraine as we know it today exists to a large extent because the Soviet Union went out of its way to carve out its boundaries and promote its culture?
Absolutely. So I think it's absolutely fair to say that there would be no contemporary Ukraine as we know it without the Soviet Union. And that's because when the Soviets came to power, they were interested in reversing the damaging effects of what they saw as Russian imperialism in the 19th century. And part of what this meant for them was promoting minority nationalities. It's a policy that one scholar has likened actually to affirmative action policies. So the idea here was that ethnic Ukrainians in the peak of the 19th century Russification campaigns had been oppressed, and that Ukrainians should rule Ukraine. So what this meant was that the Soviets came in and they made Ukraine a real centerpiece of their nationalities policy. They promoted the Ukrainian language. They promoted the Ukrainian culture. They made Taras Shevchenko, the 19th century national poet, into kind of a cult figure, publishing, you know, popular works of his that every Soviet home now has. And they made Ukrainians the dominant power politically in Ukraine.
So as you said, this history gets complicated. How much does Putin have to explain it to Russians today? Do they know this history? I mean, or is it all a long ago story for them that has little relevance?
This story is very, very alive in Russia. Putin actually recently erected a statue of Vladimir, as the Russians call him, Volodymyr, as Ukrainians call him, right in front of the Kremlin. And this man, Vladimir, was the prince of Rus who converted the Rus people to Orthodoxy. So having that statue right in front of the Kremlin, you know, brings this history front and center and again reminds us that this is a centerpiece of Putin's politics. So it's definitely something that people in the region are familiar with, but I would say they're familiar with a very particular version, right? One that tends to erase Ukrainian agency from the story, one that tends to paper over some of the complexities and ironies that I've talked about, and one that makes a straight line from Kievan Rus to the Russian Empire, to the Soviet Union, to a Russia that has dominance over Ukraine today. And that line, as I've suggested, is not quite as straight as Putin might suggest.
Faith Hillis is a professor of Russian history at the University of Chicago. She's also the author of Children of Rus, Right Bank Ukraine, and the Invention of a Russian Nation. Faith, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
From Kiev to Kharkiv, the world's Daniel Offman was on assignment in Ukraine over the past 2 weeks and sent us reports about how Ukrainians are feeling the rise in tension with its neighbor Russia. Daniel spoke with people in border towns in the east, government officials, military veterans, musicians. He even took us on a scavenger hunt for bomb shelters in Kiev. Check out his reporting and all of our coverage of the Ukraine-Russia story at theworld.org/Ukraine. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.